This is BPN Radio, your 24-hour internet prayer station, calling America to pray. It's time now for the Christian War Room with your host, Michael Schonborn. Now, here's Michael.
I think one thing is certain, we are living in a very crazy world, in a very screwed up world these days. And one of the things which we find is that the whole thing of transgenderism, a lot of people don't understand where this all comes from. And it's a whole idea that, you know, a person is trapped in the wrong body is called gender dysphoria. And there's a history behind it. It all started in the 1960s. And sort of it took its way. And today we are at a place where what's happening today is if a five-year-old suddenly, this is what we are getting to and what we're heading for. If a five-year-old suddenly, you know, thinks he, a boy, five-year-old boy thinks he's a girl. Yeah. So, then he immediately gets put onto this transgenderized, pathway. He's going to be taken to a doctor. The doctor is going to, you know, make certain decisions. They dress him up as a girl, give him certain hormones, give him puberty blockers by the time he's 16 or 18, as it is today. Then the mutilation starts taking place and they, you know, take the genitalia off and try to turn this person into a girl. This is sort of the madness which is coming in. Nobody really talks about what is happening long term to these people. What's happening with the medication? Is this ethical in any way? It goes even further. If you decide to go for a therapy to try and sort the head out in this person's situation, yeah. So to give them counseling to become, you know, to stay, you know, affirm their original gender, like, i.e. they are male, you know, make sure that they understand that they are male and that they can accept their masculinity. If you do this in certain states in the United States, it's against the law and you lose your license to practice, and you may even have to fear prison time. And so straight away you are boxed in, you know. This is, you know, what is going to happen. So there's no more professional judgment which is allowed. So we've got a gentleman here, his name, let me just check it quickly out. His name is Quentin Van Meter, and he is a pediatric endocrinologist. And he talks about this whole issue and the way it's been politicized. So in my opinion, it's very important to listen to this man and to see what he has to say, and also to look at what's been happening within the scientific community, that only one agenda is going to be considered and the other one with scientific evidence suggesting that whatever is proposed here is not right, and that there is a different way of dealing with this problem of gender dysphoria, that this is completely ignored. Yeah? The evidence is falsified, the scientific review papers are not taken seriously and they are suppressed, which suggests that it may be a better way to have a biological male, you know, to get them on the pathway to accept their masculinity and to become male, that this might be the answer statistically and medically. So this has all been suppressed and this is considered to be, you know, reactionary and not the right way of doing things. So again, we are coming with political correctness into science, and science has to bow down to the god of political correctness. And political correctness is defined by some people who may not fully understand all the implications. And so everything has to sort of yield to a certain way. Again, why is this a war room activity? We need to understand what is really going on. Yeah? So it's obviously, there's the obvious scenario. You can go back to the Bible, you can go back to Genesis, you can look at what Genesis says. There's a definition, a clear definition of male and female. There's a problem which is pointed out in the New Testament, where certain aspects of or certain lifestyles are considered to be sinful, and we need to stay away from those. Now, obviously, by the power of God, we can do this, and we can, you know, get back on the straight and narrow path, you know, where we should be and where we can fulfill our potential as children of God, as servants of God. Okay, that's from the Christian point of view. But it is very interesting when you look at the scientific point of view and you see that the scientific point of view pretty much confirms the Christian point of view. But then you go to the next stage and you see what is happening in this world, that there's just some sort of perversion where truth is no longer wanted, but instead it is just a dogma which is, you know, spouted out by a small group of people, and they try to push this dogma into our societies and nowadays into our children. And what they are doing is they are destroying children, you know, at a very young age, and they are turning them into something which ultimately is going to lead to their destruction, where people cannot cope anymore, and they will, you know, try and end up in, you know, suicide. Suicide attempts among transgender people, they're about 40%. So if you decide, I mean, I've heard this argument, you know, between a man and a woman, and this was one of these, you know, these documentaries which come out where suddenly a boy thought that really he is a girl. The mother was very supportive, the father freaked out. And then the argument of the mother is, what do you want? Do you want, you know, a child, which is alive, or do you want a son because of this, you know, problem he has in his life, who's going to commit suicide and who's going to destroy himself? Now, the chances are that once you go through this process and once you go through this treatment, that to 40% there will be a suicide attempt in his life. So that's about just less than half. That's statistical data. And Sweden, who's a very tolerant country and very positive about all this stuff, they did some studies on this and they found out that the suicide rate compared to the average society, you know, is 20% higher for people who go through this procedure. 20 times higher. Okay, let's listen to the talk. The talk is, again, is going to be split up in two sections. From Quentin van Meter, who is discussing this sort of thing. So he starts off with the history, and then later on he looks at what we really should be doing. Okay, stay tuned here at the Christian War Room. If you want to look at the talks, let me just check out. This talk is going to be talk number 126. The next talk is going to be 127, and you can go to it at christianwarroom.com.
I'm a pediatric endocrinologist who practices in private practice in Atlanta. I'm on the clinical faculty of two medical school pediatric departments in Atlanta. Love teaching, love clinical practice. I've been an endocrinologist for 38 years. I've been practicing pediatrics for 42 years. Had a 20-year career in the Navy before I retired from the Navy as a pediatrician and a pediatric endocrinologist, and moved to Atlanta under sort of unusual circumstances that turned out to be fantastic for me and for my family as we raised our kids to adulthood in that lovely part of the South. So my experience in transgender medicine goes all the way back to my fellowship days at Johns Hopkins, where I trained. And I'll start discussing the issue looking backwards at the history of transgender medicine as it has unfolded in the United States. I refer to the Three Musketeers, Alfred Kinsey. He was not a physician. He had a degree of science in entomology, which is the study of insects. He started because of his interest in sex, at the Kinsey Institute in 1947. John Money, who was a psychologist, trained, graduated from Harvard, and joined the faculty at Johns Hopkins as a clinical psychologist in 1951. I read a little bit of his biographical statement about his relationship with Johns Hopkins as a young person. And he was not a physician, did not go to medical school, but he did say he spent Saturdays in the pediatric endocrine clinic for a year, and as far as he was concerned, he was better trained than most pediatric endocrinologists. So he visioned himself as a medical physician and an expert in the field, even though he had no formal training. And then Harry Benjamin, who I originally had assumed was a psychologist or a psychiatrist, turns out he was a general medicine physician who also had a whole lot of interest in things related to sex, and he had a private practice that failed a number of times. It finally took hold in New York City, and he would go to San Francisco in the summer and practice there. So this is the picture. If you look closely, there's a person on your far right. That was me as a fellow. I had hair, and it was dark back in those days. And in the center, you can see another person who is a circled head, and that is the infamous Dr. John Money. Looks like he has a horn coming up out of behind his head there, which is sort of appropriate. He introduced the term gender as a psychological construct. Previous to the 1950s and 60s, the concept of gender was actually developed for languages. So you had masculine nouns and you had feminine nouns. So it was le chat and das Hund in, for dog and cat in French and German. And then feminine, la chaise and die Kirche, which was for the chair and the church in French and German, respectively. So John Money decided, he decided lots of things. He had lots of ideas in his head, and he thought that gender was going to be used as a term to show the internal sexed self as either male or female. So it was taken out of the linguistic world in the 1950s and 60s and placed as a term in the field of identifying human beings and their gender orientation. So he started what he called the psychohormonal group at Johns Hopkins. He had trained in Boston and was intrigued by the opportunity to study patients that had issues with sexual differentiation, so-called hermaphrodites or pseudo-hermaphrodites. And at Johns Hopkins, at that time, it was sort of the place where steroid biochemistry was being unfolded and the concept of how cortisol is made and how the offshoots of the steroid hormones are developed by, in the adrenal gland and what mistakes in nature happened to cause what we now call disorders of sexual differentiation. So most of the patients in the United States and actually from around the world were referred to Baltimore to be evaluated for what caused their disorder of sexual differentiation. And this is a very tiny fraction of patients. We're not talking about hundreds and thousands. We're talking about initially 10 or 12 patients that were studied just to look at why the nature, the accident of nature happened and what the consequences were on physical exam. So John Money thought, well, there is an opportunity for me as an interested psychologist to look at the concept of where one perceives their gender and if social circumstances can change a person's gender successfully. So that he decided he was drawn to Johns Hopkins as a result. So he joined the faculty and established protocols to evaluate these kids, both pre-treatment and post-treatment, and to see what happened in patients with abnormal anatomy or early or delayed puberty. So he developed, in, at the same time, an adult transsexual program, and it was not called transgender then, it was called transsexual. These were adult patients who believed they were born into the wrong body, and were they were recruited in through newspapers locally and regionally through the grapevine. There was no internet back then. And they had cross-dressed these individuals in their intended new gender for 2 years. It needed, that was the social transition phase first. And then they administered cross-sex hormones subsequently if they had been able to succeed in their new gender role in the workplace and at home socially. They did not have puberty blockers because these were all adults who had already been through puberty. The surgical procedures then to alter their genitalia were developed, and they actually, in the process of learning on big people, the surgeons translated that down to surgeries that could be done on infants and toddlers who had abnormal genitalia that needed correction. So there was a spin-off from the adult program that worked its way down through pediatric surgeons and subspecialists. So this is one of the patients that was that changed from male to female. We, as a pediatric endocrine fellows, unfortunately, were the ones that had to follow these patients into their adulthood, even though they weren't pediatric patients. So Don Trella, as you might have guessed, had a day job, and it wasn't a particularly socially acceptable one. Money scientific protocols. He had an idea, and he says, "I have." He would actually call up and say, "I've been thinking. I have a really neat idea." And then he would say, let's do something to the patient and see how it comes out. Now, this sounds bizarre in an era where we are so intent on following good science, but that's as far as his science went. So John Money decided he was one of the leaders in medical castration of sex criminals. The only drug that we had at the time that would work was medroxyprogesterone long-acting, or so-called Depo-Provera. And that was given to incarcerated individuals in prisons that had been sex offenders to see whether or not they could control their sexual urges. He had directed interviews with our pediatric patients who had disorders of sexual differentiation or who had precocious puberty for either reasons that couldn't be discovered or who had tumors that produced these kinds of hormones. During these interviews, the boys were taught how to masturbate. We actually had to read through these reports, and the interviews were very interesting because the first time a six-year-old boy with precocious puberty came in, the interviewers would say, how often do you masturbate? And the little six-year-old would sort of scratch his head and say, what's that? And so they would show him on with a pencil, this is how you masturbate. Next interview, you came in, the boy was masturbating six times a day. So it was a kind of a lead-on interview. It was actually rather perverted, but this is the kind of stuff that John Money's program produced at Johns Hopkins, a very venerable institution. And there was the tragic case of the newborn boy twin who had an amputated penis. During the process of trying to do a circumcision, the unwitting surgeon took a Bovie knife, which is an electrocautery device, to touch an area that was bleeding and essentially burnt the child's penis off to the base. And so that boy in the newborn nursery had a brother, twin brother, and that boy was raised at the advice of John Money as a girl. Surgically, the gonads were removed. The stump of the what was left of the phallus was sort of fashioned into a clitoris. There was a vaginal opening created using the surgical techniques, and this child went home from the hospital as a girl. Then there's a case that I took care of, a child named David, who came down from Buffalo, New York, to our clinic because he had what was called a micropenis, a very, very tiny phallic structure and no palpable testicles in the scrotum. We evaluated this child at age 6 weeks, and we decided we would put this child through a protocol, it was to use a hormone that would stimulate the testicles to produce testosterone. In doing so, we would, A, find out if the baby did have testicles, and after that, would find out if the testicles produced testosterone, would the baby's penis grow, and would the tissue respond. All those things were very important for us to know in terms of figuring out what this child should be raised, either a boy or a girl. So unbeknownst to us, John Money we thought he was out of the country, but he actually had come back early from a tour somewhere, and he interviewed this family without our knowing it before the family left home and told the mother and the grandmother that what we were doing with hormones was absolute nonsense. There was no possible way that the child was going to be able to be raised as a boy because nothing we could do would fix that. So he sent the baby home with the mother and the grandmother, telling them to change the name, and they chose Tabitha, and to cross-dress the baby as a girl. 6 weeks later, the baby came back for us to evaluate the baby, and the baby, Tabitha, had a normal-sized penis and testicles down in the scrotum, indicating clearly that it was just a boy with a pituitary deficiency and not somebody that needed to have their sex changed. It was that particular case that sort of ended the relationship of John Money with the Pediatric Endocrine Division at Johns Hopkins, and later they closed his program down. So the suicide, that boy with the ablated penis who was raised as a female, what this showed was this is a boy who was in utero, had all the XY chromosome information that said every cell of his body is male. He had the hormones that bathed his brain, because there was no problem of hormone deficiency. His testosterone programmed his system from the beginning. He was changed into a girl surgically as a costume. And he knew throughout his young childhood that something was not right. And when his parents finally fessed up and told him what the story was, he insisted that he be changed as a young teenager back to a boy. And he assumed that role. And then he committed suicide. That made headlines across the country, and that was sort of the last nail in the coffin for John Money and his crazy ideas. So the interesting thing about the disorders of sexual differentiation, and I, as a fellow, had learned that if you had a baby that looked completely feminized or non-virilized, there was no possible way that that child could be reared as a male. It would have to be reared as a female. The study of long-term follow-up of these patients, there were 16 of them. Two of them ended up remaining as they were natally, as males. The parents did not want any surgery or any correction. Of the 14 that did, 8 ended up going back up and reclaiming their natal sex as a male. So even with our well-intentioned ideas based on the concept that gender is your natal sex is not innate, that there's gender that can be changed by society, it turned out that was not the case. So the poor outcome in adults, the adults that went through the transsexual program at Johns Hopkins ended up as a group of about 50 patients. They were studied in adulthood, and they seemed a bit content with their new selves, except that their female appearances were pretty much caricatures of females. They were almost like Disney characters instead of actual women. They wore an incredible amount of makeup. They had no incentive to think about any parenting skills, and they ended up keeping all of their neuroses they had beforehand. They were not improved at all. And so on that basis, Paul McHugh, who joined the faculty at Johns Hopkins a long time before and who became the psychiatrist-in-chief in 1974, closed down all of the efforts at Hopkins that had been started by John Bunny. So if we look at transgender clinical services over the decades before 2006, in the Netherlands, they had adults that persisted with gender identity, and they were treated with medicine to transform them, their physical appearance to the opposite sex, and they were also treated surgically. In Toronto, Dr. Kenneth Zucker, who was a psychologist, had a large series of patients who he counseled through their gender identity crisis and got them to be essentially returned to their natal sex in 98% of the cases in boys and upwards of 80%+ in females. It is that classic work, that long, hard 35 to 40 year experience of his patients in Toronto that gives us the strong statistics about the resistance of the transgender identity. Then he had experience with greater than 500 patients, 560 patients to be exact. Then in Boston, Dr. Norman Spack had taken a trip over to the Netherlands. He was sort of fascinated with the transgender idea. And he went to the big clinics in the Netherlands where this had been in practice for a number of years. And he thought this would be a great idea to start in the United States. And so he came back to Boston and started what was the first East Coast Transgender Center in 2006. So in 2006, there were basically two places in the country where if you had transgender issues as a patient, you could be referred to the experts since Baltimore was gone. And that was in Boston and then eventually in Los Angeles. Now, there's a group called the Harry Benjamin Society, named after that infamous character who was one of the three Musketeers sexologists. Its membership requirements are very, very strict. You have to be interested in transgenderism. That's it. You do not have to be trained in medicine. You do not have to be, all you have to do is say, I'm really a proponent of transgenderism. And you sign up and you get in as a membership. That's a professional society, supposedly, and there is no requirements for specific education or professional background. So the Harry Benjamin Society sort of disappears, and in its place is the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, or WPATH as it's known. WPATH is not happy with the existing medical literature. The studies we had from Kenneth Zucker with his greater than 500 patients showed that resistance of transgenderism was prevalent if you let these kids go through puberty naturally. That's a large number of patients, 560 to be studied over all those years. And then the study from Sweden, which is a country which has been very permissive and very accepting socially of transgender patients into adulthood, published a study of 330 plus patients, or 324 patients, of transgendered adults who persisted into adulthood and had been treated either with medication or medication and surgery. And their data showed that there was a 20-fold increase in suicide in those patients compared to the non-transgender community. That blows it out of the water. This is not something you can sweep under the rug as a poor study, poorly conceived. It was every single patient, like it or not, was included in the study. And again, the same thing with Dr. Zucker's study. He did not exclude a single one of his patients from the database. So the WPATH, in order to get around this kind of powerful research and experience, creates its own bibliography. The quality of the studies that they research are poor for a number of reasons. They're very, very small numbers, studies of as little as 5 patients. The recruitment is based on people saying, we're going to publish a study about how you're doing as a transgender. Please contact us if you're interested. Okay. Now, in a society where if you are not happy with your transgender self, you are going to be ostracized and receive death threats, you're not probably going to raise your hand and come to that study and be recruited. You're going to sit quietly and say absolutely nothing about how miserable you are. So it's a biased population. I want all happy people to raise their hands. Okay, all happy people, raise your hands. Are you happy? Gosh, 100% correlation. Okay, so it's like the silliest thing in the world to call that good science. We don't do that with other areas. There are no control groups in their studies. Very, very few of them, if any, have anything that could be considered a study where they had a treated arm and an untreated arm in the study and compared the outcomes. So, and there are many anecdotal case reports. If you look through the WPATH bibliography, it's woman, you know, transfers to male, has happy life. Okay, and it's basically the woman writing her happy self, or the guy writing his happy self, saying how wonderful things came out. So their bibliography is full of these kind of anecdotal things. They also use recycling of the same information. Somebody will write an article in a journal that is perhaps based on some kind of competent research or incompetent research, and then that will be quoted, and then that will be rewritten into an article in what we call a throwaway journal, which is a journal that basically does, you know, articles, sort of summary articles for people who are interested in the field but are not specializing in that field, and they want to know a little bit about it. And in pediatrics, Pediatric News is one of those, or Pediatric Annals, or Contemporary Pediatrics. These are not journals that have peer review with the kind of restrictions for the scientific journals. They're basically sort of like a throwaway rag at the grocery store, where you've got a summary real quickly where you can go through bullet points and maybe learn something and file it away if you're interested in that. So they'll recycle it through those, and all of a sudden there'll be 5 different articles and 5 different throwaways, all about the same subject, all written by the same person, and they count those as 5 independent references. So this is how the WPATH, the bibliography, comes about. Citations that are marginally related are used. They'll in the list, if you pay attention, they'll say something about chick oviduct bioassay in the castrated rat.
Sorry for this abrupt ending. We've only got a half hour slot, but we're going to carry on with this talk tomorrow. You can obviously listen to the second part on christianwarroom.com. And I would encourage you to just listen to the whole thing. This talk is going to be number 126. The next talk is going to be 127. So just go to christianwarroom.com, go to the audio section, and you can click on it and just listen to the full talk. Just fast forward a bit if you want to go straight to the talk and not listen to the introduction chatter. So that's important. It's a big issue. We are finding that schools are going to be inundated with, all the LGBT stuff. And there's going to be, again, a shift, a paradigm shift that's taking place right in front of our eyes. And it's moving away from the way God wants things to the way, you know, this world sees things. Okay. Next talk tomorrow on warroom.com, christianwarroom.com.
For the past half hour, you've been listening to the Christian War Room with host Michael Sean Bourne. For more information on how you can participate or find out more about the Christian War Room, simply go to christianwarroom.com. That's christianwarroom.com.